intimidation is massive. And so many people are so intimidated. And they cannot come out in public. If they come out, I always tell this story. I had a very close friend of mine. And once comes over to me and tells me, I'll do everything I can to support you financially. But I have a big business in New York City. If I join you in person, they take a picture of my face, I close down the business the same day, which is unfortunately true. But when you see vocal people outside on the streets, you can imagine how many more people are behind them, supporting them in each and every way.
A few more questions. Would you be able to explain to what extent AIPAC influences the American political life?
AIPAC is a very sad entity. Unfortunately, AIPAC is manipulating each and every politician in the United States. Whoever doesn't go in total in line with AIPAC is committing political suicide. Tomorrow they'll lose their position or they would never get in office. This is unfortunately how it is. It's very sad. It's a disadvantage to everyone. And there's so much to speak about this. But unfortunately, this is something that we totally oppose. We protest AIPAC each and every year during their annual conference in Washington, D.C. And we say what we have to say about them.
What risks do Jewish activists take when they publicly criticize Israeli policies or support Palestinian rights? You've traveled a lot and you live in a country where protests have been quite...
Well, we have all different kinds of attacks, starting from verbal to physical to financial. For example, in my town where I live, it was after October 7th when we started with very intense work on Palestine. And two of our people lost prestigious positions because of their activities. They were given a choice. If you stop, then it's okay. And both of them did not choose to stop. They continued and lost the position. These kind of things happen in many other communities. This is just from my little neighborhood where I live. This happens all the time. The Zionist movement makes sure that people should be very aware the price that they are going to pay. And still in all, people are brave and do what's supposed to be done. And again, coming back to that point, despite all intimidations, brave people are still doing what's supposed to be done. And this just shows you, you can imagine how many more people are behind these people, these active people. For each and every person you see on the street, there are thousands behind that individual.
Do you think the Jewish resistance to Zionism is growing internationally? And if yes, what signs support your view?
It is growing. We are seeing much more people today understanding way more than 2 years ago. But even, almost every decade we see a change. We see in the young generation. And when you see, the proof to that is when you see public activities, you see two things. You see more people out there. You see stronger activities, much more financial support behind it. There is so much more going on now than before.
How can Jewish communities worldwide help separate Judaism from state violence and rebuild trust with the Palestinians?
I encourage every Jewish individual, every Jewish community to make a public stance. What exactly the language should be, every individual should choose their own language, how they do it, but they should make clear that we don't support these crimes, we don't support the state of Israel, we are Jews, and we are not Zionists. This is what's supposed to be done. Many, many Jewish people put a little sign on their door in front of their house. I'm a Jew, not a Zionist.
What would you say to Jewish people who reject the war but remain silent out of fear?
Well, I cannot judge those people. I can only encourage. We have to do more. Nobody should judge anyone because challenges are very difficult, and I'm not the person to judge anyone. I can only encourage. We need to do what's right. We need to do it for the sake of Almighty God. We need to do it for the sake of the oppressed people of Palestine and for the sake of the Jewish people.
How do you see the solution to the Palestinian cause? Would a referendum among the indigenous population of historical Palestine to decide the future be an ideal democratic solution?
I believe that this is not only an ideal solution. This is the only solution. We have to leave this for the Palestinian people. We have to stop all violence. We have to stop this occupation in its entirety. We need to restore all rights to all oppressed peoples. We have to allow all refugees to return to their homes, towns, and villages. And that's the only way to peace. And I'm saying this not only because the Palestinian people deserve their deserved rights, but this will be in favor of the Jewish people as well. We lived in Palestine before this state of Israel, and we didn't have a need for the state of Israel. On the contrary, the state of Israel has destroyed the safety of the Jewish people in Palestine. We would love to go back to old history and stop all these crimes, all these obstacles to peace, all these causes for conflict. And this is exactly what needs to be done. Let's leave it up to the indigenous population of Palestine to decide what government they want to have. If they want to have an Islamic religious government, we as Jewish people, we are happy because we strongly believe that by a Islamic religious government in the Holy Land, the Jewish people would be way more protected and the Jewish religion would be way more respected than today in this secular so-called Jewish government.
What's your take on U.S. President Donald Trump's so-called peace plan that he came up with a few weeks ago?
I'm an American Jew. I'm Jewish by the religion I follow. I'm American by nationality. My religion requires of me to be respectful to the government where I live. I am respectful to my government. I'm respectful to my president, regardless whether I agree with each and every policy. That said, I can only say what my religion teaches me. The state of Israel is wrong. This has to stop in its entirety. This is what is the will of God, and this is what will bring good for everyone.
Last question. What is your view on Press TV launching a Hebrew language service? And do you think such a platform can help reach the Jewish community inside historical Palestine audiences with alternative perspectives?
This is an excellent approach. People need honest journalism. There are so many good-hearted, right-minded people that are open for the truth. But if there is no way for them to reach the truth, there is almost no option for them to come out with right decisions. This is an excellent approach, and I can only hope that this will bring so much good for humanity.
Rabbi, thank you so much for your time today.
You're very welcome.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners. You are tuned into Iran Radio, broadcasting from Tehran, and I'm your host from the next hour. Here are some interesting facts about the Holy Quran. Surah Yasin is considered the heart of the Quran for its tremendous benefits for the believer. The best drink according to Quran is milk. In the Quran, Allah also describes the rivers of milk in heaven. The best food according to Quran is honey, which cures several problems and is the sweetest gift to humans from Allah. Normally, the Quran declares Friday as the most blessed day of the week, and the month of Ramadan is the best month of the year. And the night of Qadr has been described as a night better than 1,000 months. Its significance is described in chapter Al-Qadr. And now we'll listen to the continuation of Iran Radio. We start off with the Spotlight, a daily program which covers the most important events happening in the world today. After that, we have Back to Reality. Guests on this program have experienced living in a non-Muslim country. The main theme of the program is Muslims living in non-Islamic country. And to round up this hour's programs, we have Iran today. The program presents the latest advances in science and technology in the Islamic Republic of Iran. It also highlights the latest business and economic developments in Iran. Stay with us for the next hour.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. U.S. households are confronting a deepening affordability squeeze, and that is reshaping how they shop, dine, and finance daily life, creating new challenges for U.S. leadership, and is fueling growing discontent with U.S. President Donald Trump's job performance. In fact, a recent NBC News poll found 66% of voters feel Trump has fallen short of expectations around inflation and the cost of living. Younger Americans continue falling further behind as well. Just last month, a housing study showed that people born in the 1990s are projected to retire with home ownership rates 9.6 percentage points lower than the previous generation. Now, according to a Poverty Tracker annual report also from Columbia University, over half of U.S. residents in major cities, including a quarter of all children, either live in poverty or are low income. The price of major food staples like eggs, sugar, and meat, especially beef, increased in 2025 and are expected to continue rising. Here's a package.
U.S. President Donald Trump held a campaign-style rally at the Mount Airy Casino Resort, aiming to convince Americans that his economic policies are successfully tackling a persistent cost of living crisis. His message of a rapidly improving economy, however, was directly challenged by recent government data and the experiences of every U.S. citizen. Facing political pressure with midterm elections approaching, Trump asserted that prices were dropping, credited his administration's policies, shifting blame to his predecessor, President Joe Biden.
And I have no higher priority than making America affordable again. That's what we're going to do. And again, they caused the high prices and we're bringing them down. It's a simple message.
Trump's optimistic assessment clashes with key economic indicators. Government figures show that while the price has fallen from recent peaks, broader inflation remains stubborn. The annual consumer price index sat at 3% in September, higher than at any point during Trump's first term and above the rate in Biden's final full month in office. Essential grocery items continue to see sharp increases. Beef prices are up nearly 15%, bananas 7%, and coffee more than 20% compared to a year ago. Other metrics show job growth has slowed and unemployment has risen to a four-year high during Trump's current term. The rally revealed a notable adjustment in the Trump rhetoric. After facing criticism for recently dismissing affordability concerns as a Democratic hoax, Trump appeared to recalibrate.
And I can't say affordability hoax because I agree the prices were too high, so I can't call it a hoax because they'll misconstrue that. But they use the word affordability, and that's their only word. they say affordability, and everyone says, oh, that must mean Trump has high prices.
Trump's approval rating on his handling of the cost of living remains low at 31%, indicating the steep challenge he faces in convincing the public of an economic turnaround. U.S. citizens' daily experiences at grocery stores and gas stations are forming a powerful counter-narrative to the optimism projected from the podium. The Pennsylvania event is the first in a series planned by Trump and his cabinet ahead of the 2026 midterms. The location was strategically chosen. Pennsylvania's 8th district is a competitive area seen as critical for Republicans to hold control of Congress. For voters facing higher prices, the gap between Trump promises and their reality is widening. Millions of Americans are deeply frustrated with their affordability and their economy, threatening the very foundations of Trump's political support.
And now your guests for the program. Sir John Edmonds, economist, academic, and author, joining us out of Massachusetts. And Marcia Baker, economic expert, joining us out of Washington, D.C. Hello, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll do the gentlemanly thing here, and Ms. Baker, we'll start with you. Your initial thoughts, please, on the financial situation that most Americans seem to find themselves in these days.
Well, the United States is in a phase of economic decline, so there's no question about the data coming out that households are facing higher prices in everything, from housing to food and so forth. But it's also true that if you have an economy where credit that is available only going into speculation, to data centers, to non-basic areas. It's not going into steel, independent farming, new health care. If these basic sectors are declining while your debts and speculation are increasing as a nation, we have $100 trillion in total government, private, and debts of all kind, plus a toxic cloud above that, of derivative and crazy speculation plus crypto. This is impossible now to hide or to deny by households. This week, just one example, Washington, the Trump administration had to announce they'll make available a bridge grant of $12 billion in aid by the end of February to farmers and ranchers in the country, because their livelihoods are not stable and they're facing ruin. So definitely this is an economic decline picture, not a temporary cycle or a dip or something that's going to be fixed by today's new Federal Reserve interest rate changes.
Thank you, ma'am, for your initial take there. Professor John Edmonds, welcome to the program, sir. Mr. Edmonds, your initial take, please, on today's economic pressure on American families. Why is it just up until it seems like about 20 years ago, possibly the last time we saw a decent percentage of American families have the opportunity to sit down, plan, save, and invest for in their future was around 2005 or 6. It seems it's really like we barely hear that from families have that luxury these days.
Thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate this opportunity, and I certainly agree with the assessment of the other presenter. I'm the guy in my house who goes to the grocery store. I don't think that the president goes to very many grocery stores. I go routinely once or twice a month, and I not only buy food, but I walk around and I look at what other people are buying, and I look at what they're picking up and putting back on the shelf. And I can tell you that a lot of things that I routinely buy are much more expensive. I buy them anyway because I'm above all that, but I'm very aware of the effect of the tariffs. For example, I'm very, very much a fan of coffee, especially premium coffee, and premium coffee is a lot more expensive than it was, even though they just rolled back the tariff on coffee from Brazil. But besides that, I think we should mention the price of eggs, which a lot of people were talking about. But one reason why eggs have come down more than some other foodstuffs recently is because the farmers who grew a bunch of corn and soybeans are not able to sell it to China because China has decided that if you want to have a trade war, let's hit the group that voted in highest numbers for this government. And so they're sitting there with corn. Now you can either let it rot or you can feed it to pigs and chicken and get pork and eggs and chicken out of it. Or you can grind it up and make ethanol out of it. And ethanol is intrinsically uneconomical, especially now that we have net exports of crude oil and refined products. So I would say the cost of living is definitely going up, and a lot of people are feeling it, regardless of what anybody might say. And the other question I would bring up is, how much trust should we have in the data? I lived in third world countries where they would routinely adjust the numbers, or as we say in American slang, fudge them. But in the U.S., after the Bureau of Labor Statistics head was fired, the next person miraculously reported better numbers. I'm really astonished to tell you that, but it's not really a joke. If I got that job, I wouldn't put out any bad numbers either, but I wouldn't put out any true numbers.
Thank you, Mr. Edmonds. Ms. Baker, Democrats, meanwhile, they're making this issue of affordability central to many of their campaigns. Now, while Trump has called it, these affordability concerns, a Democratic hoax. But my question to you, how much of this mismanagement can be attributed to his administration? How much of it is just part of the trajectory that's been moving, regardless of which party's been in the Oval Office over the past few decades?
I'm sorry to say it's your suggestion that it's both parties plus independents for many decades that allowed the increased deregulation of the economy, including in North America with Canada, Mexico, and allowed transnationals to come in the case of food, which John was just mentioning shopping for, allowing the United States is 70% dependent on for fresh tomatoes from Mexico that come in trucks. Mexico, the home of corn, is 50% dependent on the U.S. sending corn to Mexico. Who gains? The Wall Street complex of transnationals, Cargill, JBS, the meat packer. We have a terminal condition of our United States economy, and it's been Democrats, Republicans all going for it. So now is the point where we have to make a change.
I'll put that same question to you, Mr. Edmonds. How guilty do you see the Trump administration? A recent poll shows 2/3 of Americans feel he is completely disconnected. His policies only favor billionaires and the wealthy. And if he has nothing, if he has little, less to do with this current crisis than many want to lead on to believing, nevertheless, it seems fair to say that his tariff wars are at least to blame to an extent. But your overall assessment of his administration's the hand they played in this current cost of living crisis in America.
The tariff wars are a big part of the current situation, but I would reaffirm what Marcia just said, that it's been many years since younger people are looking forward to having less prosperity than their parents had, and you can't do that very long and remain popular. But I would also reaffirm what Marcia said about favoring Wall Street tycoons, and particularly in the first Trump government, there was an enormous tax law change that greatly favored corporations and the wealthy. And then we have another one in this previously passed so-called Big Bill, Beautiful Bill. And the consequence is that you make more money speculating on stocks, particularly the big seven, the magnificent seven, as they're called, and you make more on that than you would on what I call real business, that is going out and making physical products. And with regard to trade in agricultural goods, yes, certainly, we have brought in tomatoes from Mexico for many, many years. And we also brought in labor from Mexico going back to the 1940s to pick the tomatoes. And then we found that many of them were staying. And then now this is a wave of anti-immigrant sentiment. So the people that used to do the physical labor in construction and the physical labor in agriculture are being sent back to where they came from, if it really is that they were not born here. But many of the people who've been picked up and deported were U.S. citizens, but that's not the subject of this particular show. But what we have is a labor shortage in several skill categories, particularly the high skill categories. The people that take my classes, for example, half of them are foreigners, and if they don't leave, then they face a deportation notice pretty quickly. But then if you look at who's actually doing the heavy physical labor, who cut your grass? Who laundered your shirts? Who was working the back room of the restaurant where you went and ate with your friends? Those people are being run out of the country. And near where I live, I'm hiring people to cut my lawn who are teenagers from the neighborhood, but they're all just leaving very promptly and going to college. So they're not available anymore. So that's turning into a pattern, which is stratification of the population, and stratification not just a rich versus poor, but super rich, not so very rich, and then the poor. We have to divide them into lower middle class and really really poor, and we're going to see them really poor after the 1st of January when their health care premiums go up. A lot of people are going to have to drop health care. And those who retain it won't have money for anything else.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Ms. Baker, nearly $1 trillion, you very well know, in military spending each and every year. And ironically, the student loan debt that's accrued over all the years has reached an unprecedented $1.81 trillion today, according to the Education Data Initiative. Can some of the problems in the U.S. financially be better resolved if there's a logical and calculated reshuffling of priorities by policymakers?
Yes, that is part of it. In other words, we should reset policy based on principle, which we can work out. We have precedents in the 1930s in the United States when the new president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, came in. A bill was passed named after two senators called Glass and Senator Stegall, and they reorganized banking. So you had banking of credit you need for operations and economic activity, and you did not back up finance for speculation. You put a wall in between. There is a move now, rightly, to reintroduce that in the United States. And it has, in different forms, it has a universal principle. China observes it. Other nations observe it. So that's the kind of setting aside unworthy, unpayable debt. I call unworthy debt a lot of the trillions in speculative counter obligations on derivatives connected to Wall Street, City of London, the international billionaire class. It's going to otherwise explode. I can't tell you which day, but it's unsustainable. Then we can organize credit for priority projects, rebuild rail, and collect majority who's building in Africa and other places, ports, dams, electricity, that can get us out of the otherwise inevitable crisis you're seeing worsen here in the U.S.
I can put that same question to you, Mr. Edmonds. Today, you very well know unemployment. Well, you may not know, but unemployment today in America has risen to its highest level in 4 years, and consumer prices, this you know, remain high and seem to be getting worse by the day. Housing costs are a nightmare, whether you're a buying or a renter or paying a mortgage. I mean, higher education, you very well know, it's very pricey, while entry-level jobs for a graduate pay the equivalent of a fast food chain. What needs to change by policymakers to address this current crisis?
Well, let's start with the student loans. When I got my various degrees, I graduated owing $11,000 in debt, and my salary was much higher than that already. But then besides that, the interest rate on those debts were low, inflation was high, and the interest was tax deductible. So by the time I finished paying off those loans, they were less than my monthly electric bill, and I honestly didn't even notice it, whereas this generation, if they got half the degrees that I have, they would have a debt burden that they can't pay. Now, another thing that has really happened, which is quite profound and definitely damaging the generation of people that are now turning 18 or 25, is the compensation that people get is so much lower. When I was an undergrad, I got a job washing dishes for a while for $2.50 an hour. And then a very short while later, I got a job programming computers at $10 an hour. In other words, the ratio of 4 to 1, what I got for white collar work versus blue collar work. That ratio is now nowhere near as large. I mean, right now, people around where I am right now are making $17 an hour working in a fast food restaurant. And if they're running the cash register, they're making $19 an hour. And if they're sitting in the office doing the books, they're probably also making $19 or maybe $21 an hour. And then where's the 4-to-1 ratio? It's gone. So getting a college degree, I cannot look an 18-year-old in the eye right now and say you should bend every effort and even incur some debt to get a college degree. It wouldn't be a rewarding investment. And that's devastating. And when you combine that with deporting the people that do get a college degree, you end up with a population that is underqualified for the jobs that are available. So unemployment comes from that. That is to say, there's a lot of people out there who'd like to have a job, or they'd like to have a better job than what they have now, but they can't qualify. They don't have the skill levels, and that's chronic. It's throughout the country, and it seems to just be a fact of life. And you can complain about it, but you can't seem to make it any better.
And since, I was going to ask a different question, Ms. Baker, but since Mr. Edmonds referred to deporting and immigrants a few times, I'll put this question to you if I could. Politicians, especially Donald Trump, he seized on the opportunity time and again to evade any responsibility for the current economic affairs of the country, and he's pitting his base against immigrants, saying that they're taking your jobs, putting strain on medical and educational infrastructure. Let's build a wall to keep them out, or let's just launch a campaign to round them up and kick them out. Is this the answer, ma'am? All the billions to Ukraine and Israel to fund an unwinnable war or fund a genocide close by? These don't get spoken about, but immigrants somehow are the demons in America today.
Well, this is both ideology and a kind of low-level reflex reaction that's no good, doesn't work, is cruel and mean. And as John has already said, if you have a difficult situation, then you load on tariffs, then you blame migration because Wall Street has not allowed economic development in Central America, in South America. So people are dislocated, looking for where they can have better lives. If you follow that path, it's hopeless, and it's also very dangerous now, being on the verge of having this stupid policy cause an attack on Venezuela here in our own hemisphere. That's crazy. Instead, if you have the development approach, that's the basis for peace and for hope in the future. And so mutually looking at development in ports, in railroads in North America, building the Alaska to lower 48 down to through Central America to South America railroad that was never properly built. That means jobs. It means a spirit of optimism. It means high skills. And when people's homelands are being developed, whether it's in Haiti or Peru or Honduras, you want to stay home and be part of the excitement. Instead, we've had this anti-development policy for over half a century or more, and inevitably that creates dislocated people. Mm. So that's the fight.
And Mr. Edmonds, I'm going to put the final thoughts with you, sir, if I could. Many Americans, I read this article just before the show by the Economic Times. It says, many Americans feel trapped in a cycle where income barely covers living costs and every paycheck is a race against time. The strain affects mental health, family stability, and productivity, creating ripple effects across communities. Now, 68% of Americans are walking a financial tightrope, and some studies suggest 7 out of 10 Americans are living paycheck to paycheck, and this includes families from not just low income levels, but all income levels, which is quite remarkable. Why is a country, sir, this rich have so many families this broke?
The paycheck to paycheck argument is certainly true. I would push the ratio even higher than that. A great many people are not really able to afford the life that they think they should have. And one thing that they can't do, they can't relocate to get another job. They can get the job, perhaps, but the job may be in another city. And there's two things that restrict their mobility. One is housing. If they have a housing situation that they can afford and they move out of that, and they move into one that they can't afford, either because of mortgage rates or because of higher rents in the places where the jobs are. But also, they can't be sure of getting health care in the new place where they would be going, and then the problem might be pre-existing conditions. So if they get health care, it might not cover some of the things that they need to have covered, and that's the big issue for this week's debate in Congress. And I'm not really hearing much debate except that each side is coming out with a plan that the other side will reject. So I don't know where we get with that, but it's not going to be an improvement. So I'm thinking that the unemployment situation will remain bad, and also that the healthcare situation will get worse. And there doesn't seem to be any political will to fix either one of them. On the contrary, the thing to do is pump more into speculation and just keep on paying more and more for the same probably overpriced stocks. I'm not going to predict a decline or a crash. I'm just going to say that if you consistently pay more than 20 times earnings for a stock in an environment where you have 3% or 4 or 5% inflation, that's not really going to give you much rate of return. But that's what everybody's doing.
And time has gotten the better of us. I want to thank you both for joining us on the program, and stay blessed to the both of you. John Edmonds joining us from Boston, Massachusetts, and Marcy Baker joining us from Washington, D.C. And this brings us to the end of your Spotlight program. Thank you for joining us, and goodbye for now.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRAB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of Back to Reality. This is Asma. Once more, I have the honor to be here with you guys. And welcome to today's brand new episode of Back to Reality. Well, so just like always, we have two very dear guests, and I enjoy their company. So just like always, you have to give us a very brief introduction about yourself. Therefore, assalamu alaikum and welcome. Let's start with ladies. Sister Zainab.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you for having me. I am Zainab and glad to be here. I am student of linguistics and at the same time have an exposure in the Hawza studies.
Thank you very much for coming here. And you, Brother Muhammad, assalamu alaikum and welcome.
Wa alaikum assalam. It's a pleasure to be here with you again. My name is Muhammad. I'm a Quran student and a Quran teacher, and I've studied English literature, but mostly I'm interested in Quranic studies.
Well, there are some times in life that we have to deal with people from different backgrounds. And now, if the background is just your nationality or coming from a different region or living in a neighbor in which you do not know other people, where they come from, how they are, maybe even in the appearance, because sometimes the people of a certain area are so different from one another, and that might look at least a bit problematic. But then imagine, because we're living in today's world, which looks like a village, and then everybody has got this access to different sort of people coming from different backgrounds and different communities. Imagine you have to live with people with different religious background. How would your relationship be? Like, from the very beginning, how would you look at it? Like, what's your impression? Would you have very personal, maybe sometimes bitter, and maybe sometimes biased sort of perception of other people?
Well, personally, I will say I have lived in that environment, because you may
have lived this assumption.
Yes, because you may have known that there's a huge number of religions in India.
Yes.
And people live in harmony, mm-hmm. many of them. And unfortunately, sometimes some politicians or some groups, they try to create distort. Otherwise, people themselves are very, very harmonious.
Okay, but you never get into religious debate?
Yeah, why not? Like, I think we should, at first level, we had this from our great grandparents would think differently than mm-hmm. our own parents and then us. Like, I think all these generations.
And you see a drastic change.
Yeah, not really a drastic, but yes, the way it changes, the way they would deal, the way our parents would, or the way we would. So when we were there, we were friends with all, like,
but your parents, maybe they had problems?
No, they were like, they had up to hi, hello, but they were not very much friends.
Oh, yeah.
And our great-grandparents, they would fare like, okay, if we will be in touch with
that's enough.
Other religions, maybe it will impact us. But like, as a young youth, we were like, okay, if my faith is not, mm-hmm. if my faith is strong, then nothing is going to affect
okay,
me.
Okay, Brother Muhammad, don't feel missed out. Please come and interfere.
Yes, I've also actually lived this assumption, like you said, as well. Like, I've lived among non-Muslims, Muslims with other denominations, and I agree that in these kinds of environments, it's a much more open-minded environment. And compared to an atmosphere where everyone is of the same religion. Like right now, if we go to the schools of such and such Muslim country, everyone is a Muslim. So they're going to be a lot more biased toward the believers of other religions. And they're going to be a lot more opposed to those who believe in a religion other than their own religion. But in the West, I've lived in the U.S. for several years, and we had people from other countries and other religions in the same classroom, and we lived in harmony. We lived together. We were very tolerant, like they say. Like, we would easily tolerate each other.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't get into a fight over our, you know, our beliefs and our special acts of worship and things like that. Okay.
What happened to you to get to that point? Because I believe that
there
might be some sort of,
you know,
religious debate. Like, imagine something happens and there is this class discussion, and then it's about religion, and then everybody starts to release what they are. They're going to convey who they actually are, what they believe in. So what happens that you come to this maturity that, okay, we have to live together and have this flexibility to tolerate each other?
Yeah. It's actually the necessity of that environment, of that culture that I was living in. You know, like in the West, we have many immigrants, we have many people from other countries, different ethnicities, exactly. And so if my classmate is, like, for example, a Christian while I'm a Muslim, we have to communicate with each other. We have to relate to each other somehow, okay? We can't just start beat each other up and say,
it's not like that. It happens.
I don't know how. It happens automatically, you know? Even at the university, like in Islamic countries, like Iran, it's the more, different and diverse the religious backgrounds, the more open-minded the classroom is going to be.
Yeah.
And I think
this is how it is.
Yeah, and I think that open-mindedness comes because you actually deal in person with those diverse people. I think this interaction that you have with these diverse kind of religions and people you're living with, interfaith, you have all those friends and colleagues around, I think this gives you opportunity to reread them. I think your actions speak much louder than your words. I think it was many of our actions that brought people closer to Islam, and they wanted to read about Islam. I remember many people would knock our door at night or, you know, sometimes in the late evening, and they would ask our father, can we have Quran? We want to read it. Why? Because, you know, when natural disaster comes, it does not see, are you a Muslim or
exactly,
a Sikh or a Hindu?
It's all inclusive.
Yes. And since we are living in a community with diverse people, it came for all. But I remember Muslims opening their mosques for old kind of people when their houses were destroyed.
Yeah.
I remember different religions coming and serving each other. So there was this very communal thing. And this taught us, this invited us to read about them and them to read about us.
Yeah.
So I think, yes, there's this always this open-mindedness.
And to come to this fraternity.
Yes,
this
and that's
friendship.
What brings harmony.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Welcome back. You are listening to Back to Reality. I'm Asma. Brother Muhammad and Sister Zainab are with us, and we're having a discussion on living and having interaction with people who've got different religious background, and specifically about youth and how their relationship would differ from their ancestors, like the previous generations. Would they be more open-minded toward this difference and incongruity in between religious backgrounds or not? And up until now, we got to this point that it's not about problems that bring us together. It's about coming to this flexibility and tolerance to treat with other human beings. This is the first building block of our discussion, that human beings are defined by their humanity. So even if there are different religious backgrounds, we have to come to this tolerance. And then you were saying something about philosophy.
Yeah, I was going to say something that's sort of philosophical. It's one of the tenets that has been put forward by the great Islamic philosopher Ayatollah Allama Misbah Yazdi. He says that we have different kind of people. Those who are compelled to accept Islam. These people, they have to accept Islam if they know that Islam is truly the righteous religion and the religion that everyone has to accept. They have to accept Islam. If they don't, they are oppressors. They are doing injustice. They are wrongdoers. Okay? But then we have a group of people who are mustadaf. Okay? He says mustadaf fikri. Means they are ideologically downtrodden. This is the translation. It means that because of their propaganda, because of the things that they hear on the news and on their television channels, they have not been able to see the truth of Islam. Islam has not become clear for them as the real religion. That is why they are mustadaf, they're downtrodden. If they don't accept Islam due to this downtroddenness, Allah will deal with them in a different way. He's going to judge them in a different way after they die.
Yeah.
And they will be given the chance to, mend their ways, basically, and fix their beliefs.
Yeah.
And this is what makes Islam really a tolerant religion.
Mm-hmm. Basically Islam, when we say like that, it reminds me again back living in the same community. When people remembered Islam as just terrorists with Al-Qaeda and gun and a long beard and that's it. While as like, as Reza said, Islam, like those who do not accept, they have a weak intellect or they have not. Basically, Islam means to submit. It does not mean that you're someone with a gun and a terrorist. Islam is not equal to terrorism.
Exactly.
We have to make it understand with our actions that we believe in submission. I have all the ways to go beyond the lines, but I submit. I do patience. Islam is about patience. Islam is about giving up on your desires. And the moment you stop giving up on your desires, you are doing zulm to yourself. You're being oppressive towards your own self, basically.
Yeah,
that's right. So the idea is that you have to set an example for others by your actions as Muslims, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Other people, they have to say, okay, look at the Muslims. Look what they're doing. Look at the Iranians. Look at, the Arabs. Look at the Afghans. And look how they are living, what they are doing. These are Muslims. Someone might say this.
Yeah.
If they're good, if they say that, wow, look at the Iranians, how they fight the Israelis, how they defend the truth, how they fight the oppressors and the occupants, and so on and so forth. When you search Shia, it shows all of the Muslims who are
doing the bloodshed and all.
Yeah.
No, they're stabbing themselves.
That has got nothing to do with Shia.
Yeah, they say that. Yeah.
So that's the propaganda, actually. You try to say that people are bombarded with different types of propaganda.
Yeah. That's why with our actions, we have to show we are not like that.
Very true. Yeah, I do believe in that. But generally speaking, since we were talking to youngsters and they were the main concern of our discussion, because nowadays it's the responsibility of the youth to improve themselves and the insights and in the everything that will lead them to have a better perspective of the world. So talking about them and their interaction with other people with different religious background, we came to this conclusion that tolerance is the main purpose that Islam would teach us, to be tolerant toward other people at the same time that you are kind and at the same time that you practice humanity with other people who have got different perspective, different religion, different ethnicity, different nationality. So it's all about creating this link of kindness and this link of coming to this same language.
Common terms.
Exactly. So this was all, and I hope we would get another chance to continue with these sort of topics, because I guess in today's world, this is a must, to come to a common language and a common sense, which would link all the individuals all around the world all together. So thank you very much, Sister Zainab, and thank you, Brother Muhammad. This was all, and thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us until another episode. I leave you to God's never-sleeping eyes. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the ummah rise again let us see daylight again once again